You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, school enrollment numbers have been declining in Wisconsin for years, but the story looks very different depending on where you are in the state. We'll hear more in a new WisContext report. First, there are a lot of issues that people feel strongly about in Wisconsin. One that's gotten people fired up on both sides of the issue is trains, high-speed rail, to be exact. While many might immediately think back to Scott Walker's 2010 campaign to become governor and his early days in office, in fact, high-speed rail has been a contentious topic in Wisconsin since the 1990s. A new WPR podcast just launched today. It's called Derailed. It's all about this issue and how it's played out in our state over several decades and in other parts of the country, too. You can listen at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked to WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the project.
When you talk about high-speed rail in Wisconsin, many people go back to one of Scott Walker's first accomplishments, which was to kill the planned route between Madison and Milwaukee. But that wasn't the beginning of the issue, was it?
No, I mean, this issue is, we started talking about it around 2009, 2010, but it had really been proposed a decade before that by another governor, Republican Tommy Thompson. And this wasn't just something that he, you know, tucked into a budget or something and didn't talk about. This is something he was very passionate about. He talked about it in a couple of his final State of the State speeches, made a very grand pronouncement about this being the future of transportation in the Midwest. He was chairman of Amtrak at the time. He was kind of setting the Republican agenda, and this was his train. This is something that he wanted to, you know, get done by 2003. You know, he was appointed to the Bush administration in 2000, and so that dream was kind of cut short for him. But that's where it got its start.
So a lot longer than some people might realize.
Yeah, I mean, it was resurrected because of the stimulus in, you know, after the election of Barack Obama. We're coming out of this, you know, great recession. The stimulus has passed and there's a huge investment in rail, and that rekindles this debate. But it started long before that.
And it's certainly been a topic of heated conversation right here on the Ideas Network over the years. Here's a taste of that from the podcast.
We wonder if you support high-speed rail in Wisconsin. Where do you want to see it go? Will you ride the trains once they're here?
I am all for the rail. I think it'll bring more transportation and more jobs to the area of Madison.
We could build a nice pyramid in the middle of Johnson's Creek for $810 million, and yeah, that would create jobs in the short term. But what good is it going to do in the long run if nobody uses it?
Saying no to rail now would be the equivalent of Walker saying no to the internet 10 years ago.
I'm a train nut, but I'm against this.
So, Bridget, why do you think this issue had and still has people on both sides so riled up?
That's such a great question. And honestly, that's one of the questions that we're trying to answer in this podcast is what is it about this train? Because the more we report on the issue, the more we've found that people on both sides of the issue, people who thought that it was going to be the future of transportation and people who thought it was just too expensive, even 10 years later, all of those people still feel very passionately about this issue. And that has been really interesting for us to dig into.
I actually remember in 2011 when all of the Act 10 protests were going on and there were all these signs and everything. And there was one guy standing there with a sign that said, "I'm still mad about the train."
Yeah, people are still mad even now.
There's one thing that when we go back and look at the events around this train, things happened so fast during this period, you know, with the election of Barack Obama and the, you know, ascent of Democrats to, you know, controlling the Senate and the House in Washington, controlling state government, the recession, the Tea Party happens, Scott Walker happens, Act 10 happens. There's just a lot that happened in those few years. And this train is kind of along for that journey. I mean, it is kind of exemplary of the debates that we were having at the time.
So, Bridget, why tackle this topic now?
Again, even 10 years later, it's one of those things that people are still really fired up about. And so in terms of being a good story, it's a great story. People feel really passionately about it. But it also is a good way to look at how our politics have changed within the last 15 or 20 years. You know, when we're talking about going from Republican Governor Tommy Thompson, who really pushed this train project, to Republican Governor Scott Walker, who ultimately killed it. The change that happened in that period is fascinating to examine.
And you mentioned in the trailer to the podcast, which people can check out at WPR.org/derailed, this issue involved three Wisconsin governors, as you said, two Republicans, Tommy Thompson and Scott Walker, with Jim Doyle in the middle. Here's a little bit of Democrat Jim Doyle and Republican Scott Walker.
I mean, I guess short of sitting down in front of the federal government and defying the federal government, I don't think it's realistic that this project would stop.
Now more than ever, we need a leader who's going to tell the federal government that we don't want an $810 million train that we don't need and can't afford.
We're talking right now with Bridget Bowden. She's WPR's special projects reporter, and Sean Johnson. He's WPR's Capitol Bureau chief. We're talking about the new WPR podcast called Derailed, a look at the history of the issue of high-speed rail in Wisconsin. So, Sean, you've been watching state politics here for a long time. What was the most interesting aspect for you looking at those three governors on this particular issue of high-speed rail?
Well, I guess the change from Tommy Thompson, the Republican, to Scott Walker, the Republican, we know they're different Republicans. They have different records. But to go from one to the other in about a decade just shows you kind of how much the politics of Wisconsin changed. So I think that's one. I think looking back at the way that Doyle handled this during the recession, and, you know, the way that he was really pushing for this in conjunction with the White House, just seeing those steps along the way and how quickly things were happening behind the scenes, and I guess how close they got, that's been interesting to look back at.
I think one of the interesting things, Bridget, is we see, as Sean said, such a difference between two different Republican governors, and yet kind of the through line on this is people feeling so strongly on both sides of it. And it doesn't seem like there was a point where overwhelmingly people felt one way or the other. There really has been this contrast and conflict through the whole thing.
I would say that it's definitely become more of a partisan issue. You know, we think about passenger rail in 2019, and it comes to mind as something that is divided along party lines. But I'm not sure that it's always been quite so divided, and we'll be getting into that.
Well, and as we heard, there were people who say, you know, I'm hugely for trains, but I'm not for this project, or I'm for economic development, but I'm not for this. And it seems like this has not been an issue where people have necessarily fallen along the lines that we might expect.
I think the lines have changed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think they do change a little bit around the time of the stimulus and this train. When Barack Obama's president, Scott Walker's running for governor, people's positions harden at this time. And I think really, if you want to step back even and look even more broadly, there's an argument to be made that people's positions on a lot of things hardened after that Great Recession, that the politics of America, of Wisconsin, which were already divided, became more so after that recession. And that's the world we're living in today.
So you're looking at these three governors and the roles that they played. What other aspects of the issue are you looking at?
A few other things. So if you remember the deal that the state had with the Spanish train manufacturer Talgo and how that fell apart, we'll be looking at that. We're also going to take a look at where some of our money went after we sent the money back to the federal government. So I took a trip out to California, which also got stimulus money and is building a high-speed rail line. And that's still happening today. So I went to check it out, see how that's going, and sort of follow the money that way.
So both states got the stimulus money. We sent it back and didn't try to build the train. California did, but little teaser here, it hasn't gone as smoothly as maybe they had hoped.
So the construction is very much still in process. They're not going to see a train for a long time, and so we'll tell you all about that.
And what else can we look forward to?
I think we're going to do our best to explore that question about what has changed and why has this particular issue become an issue that, I mean, you kind of know it when you see it. You bring this up and people are jumping out of their boots wanting to talk about it, right? So why? Why is that? I'm not sure we can definitively answer that, but I think it's a question worth asking, and it's definitely one we're going to explore.
Anything surprise either of you as you were doing your research, talking to people? Did anything stand out that for you was like, wow, I hadn't thought of that?
For me, I was surprised that the project started with Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. I didn't cover this when it happened, so it's all been kind of new for me, but that was definitely a big surprise.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I've alluded to this, but just kind of like how quickly things are happening. And I guess the way things ended up, without giving out too much information, you know, just following like what happened with the Talgo trains, for example, I think that is, you know, very interesting and I think worth a listen.
Well, thank you both so much. And we will definitely check in with you maybe towards the end of the run. How many episodes are we looking forward to?
We're looking at six, I think. We're going to say six, and, you know, it's a podcast, so maybe there's bonus content or something like that. It's, I guess, the beauty of not having that definitive end.
All right. Well, thanks both of you for joining us, Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson from WPR News.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden. They talked to Central Time Executive Producer Judith Sears-Poisson about the brand-new WPR podcast, Derailed. The first episode is available today. There will be new episodes released on Wednesdays. You can find them at WPR.org/derailed or anywhere you usually get your podcasts. Coming up, we'll look at school enrollment numbers in Wisconsin and see where numbers are going up and where they're declining. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the White House is pushing back on the House impeachment inquiry. We'll check out the latest on that and more of this week's top Washington news with a congressional reporter. First, Wisconsin school kids have been in class for about a month now, and for a lot of them, their classrooms may have fewer kids than they used to. That's in line with a trend researchers have been seeing for years now, with fewer and fewer kids enrolled in many schools. Sarah Kemp is a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She recently wrote about this in a piece for WisContext titled Why More Wisconsin Schools Are Enrolling Fewer Students. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I know it varies from place to place. Who is seeing the biggest declines in enrollment in our schools around Wisconsin?
Probably the area where we're seeing the most decline, as I've probably mentioned before in other interviews with you, is rural schools.
And What are we seeing there? I was looking at some of the charts you had in your WisContext piece. There are some big numbers, almost a half declines in enrollment.
It depends on the area, but if you look at the state as a whole, we saw an 8% decline in rural districts, what we call rural districts. And in town districts, which are a little bit larger and a little closer to cities, they haven't declined quite as much, only at about a little over a percentage point in this 13-year window that I looked at.
Now, let's before we dig more into the specifics, let's talk statewide for a little bit, even though that could cover up differences from place to place. What are the overall trends we're seeing in Wisconsin?
So I did look at three different classifications or categories of enrollment. And the first was to look at grade grouping and overall population and change. And in the public schools, K-12, we saw a 5% decrease. Many school districts also added a 4K program over this time period. And so with the addition of that program, the decline wasn't as great, only 2% for the total. And then if we look at it by elementary, middle school, and high school, the greatest decline was in high school. And middle school and grade school were much less, only at 2%, whereas high school was at 10% of a decline in this 13-year window.
And this is driven in part by demographics, of course. What are we seeing on the state level that means we have fewer kids in school?
So we have fewer children because we are having fewer births. And so that is something that definitely affects the enrollment. We see what is happening when we see this decline in high school. It's largely due to sort of like the end of the millennials leaving, and this cohort that came after the millennials are much smaller, and they're in school right now. And so so we just have a smaller population from this next generation after the millennials.
And you look back at our overall in and out migration in Wisconsin, people coming in versus people coming out. And there were a couple periods where more of us, more younger people, look like we're leaving.
We've seen what I looked at was the the movement both in the 1990s, the 2000s, and the 2010s. And we saw an increase in overall people moving in the 1990s, a little less so in the 2000s. But in from 2010 to 2015, we actually saw a decrease in people moving into the state. And the largest number of decline or less people coming in were that age group of childbearing age, so around 20 to 35. That was our age population that declined the most in the last, 5, 7 years.
We're talking to Sarah Kemp about her new WisContext piece titled Why More Wisconsin Schools Are Enrolling Fewer Students. Well, now let's break it down kind of region by region. And let's start in urban. And there's kind of a tale of two types of cities here. What do you see when you look at urban districts?
So when we look at the urban districts and it's the fewest number of districts that we have in the state, about 18 districts, but it encompasses about 30% of the student population. And if you take out Milwaukee and Racine, which are two districts that declined quite considerably, 20 and 22%. If you remove those two districts, the rest of the districts pretty much remain steady. They balanced out each other, and there was pretty steady enrollment in this time period.
Now, Milwaukee and Racine, when you say one thing leaps to mind. Those were the first places that had, I think, the voucher school programs.
They are. So they are and Milwaukee, of course, has a long history of school choice. And so maybe the enrollment decline maybe is not as much of a factor. But Racine, I didn't look specifically at that, but certainly private schools do influence that enrollment.
And do we see urban areas around the state where there are increases, balancing that out a little bit?
I don't recall offhand which. For sure, Madison, it comes to mind as an area that has the county as a whole is our fastest growing county. And so we've seen an increase for certain in the Madison School District. But off the top of my head, I can't recall the others. But there's about 5 or 6 of them.
And then what are we seeing the middle group, the suburban districts?
And so then the suburban district, which would be those districts that surround the urban areas, that is the only area or only location type of district that has seen an increase of almost 7% in this 13-year window.
And is that a factor of just more people are moving to suburban areas?
So it is. I think it's largely driven by people moving into suburban areas. The birth numbers are also higher. The number of births that occur in suburban districts are higher than in other areas of the state. And that, of course, influences enrollment as well.
Let's take it back to the rural areas we started with. What is driving declines, big declines, in some of the districts you looked at?
So the rural districts, I've been studying these rural districts for quite some time now, and we just keep seeing a growing decline. And a large driver of that is an aging population, people aging in place. Our state as a whole is getting older. And fewer births, just families that may or may not be in the area, but just that the younger families are not necessarily moving to rural areas. And then in addition, just fewer births.
And there's a big consequence of that. And we've talked to you about this and you've written for WisContext in the past. Declining enrollment means funding difficulties often for these rural schools. Can you talk about that cascade effect?
That's correct. So we see... funding is tied to enrollment. And so if enrollment is declining, a district's funding, state aid, is also reduced. And they do take a 3-year average to sort of soften that decline for funding in a district. But it definitely is affecting districts all around the state.
And even though you have fewer students, your building is the same size and you have to heat it just as much. And your buses probably have to drive just as many miles. So that can create quite a pinch for some of these
districts.
That's
right. So I don't know if you recall, back in 2016, we talked a lot about this in a piece that I wrote called Perfect Storm. And the same things were happening there are still happening today, where we are seeing, costs do not go down. If anything, they go up. Funding is going down, and then the enrollment. You still have If you have 25 children in kindergarten or 10, you still have to hire a teacher to teach those students.
And part of the story you tell in your new piece is about birth rates among different demographic groups in Wisconsin. What did you see there?
We looked at the race ethnicity of the total population. We didn't look at it in a geographic sense, but we took the total state population or state student population, and we saw a decline in births with non-Hispanic white mothers and Indian, American Indian or Native American women also showed a decrease in the number of births that they were having in this time period, back to 2000, actually. Non-Hispanic Black and Asian and Latino population all saw increases in births.
And that might be factoring into where we're seeing, obviously, more kids in our schools, depending on how those different groups are distributed.
Yes, primarily there's about 10 to 11 counties where we see a little bit more of a diversity of population, student population. The total state has about 28%, almost 30% of the population is of a student of color. But it's not dispersed throughout the state. It tends to be more in pockets of areas in the state.
So with declining enrollment numbers, what are you watching for as new data comes in from year to year?
Well, we like to track this information because it's important for policymakers to know that what the demographic trends are for students, especially because it's tied to funding. And so that's a key piece, as well as it's just very helpful to just individual districts around the state to know what the trends are.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Kemp, researcher with the School Enrollments Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She was with us today to talk about a piece she wrote for WisContext titled Why More Wisconsin Schools Are Enrolling Fewer Students. You can find that online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at congressional reaction to President Trump's sudden decision to move U.S. troops out of a key region of Syria. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tommy Thompson was with us to advocate for part of the new NAFTA deal back on Monday that he says could spur medical innovation. Today, we'll hear a different perspective from the former governor, a trade group representing generic drug makers who say that provision would unfairly protect drug companies from competition. First, the House-led impeachment inquiry is picking up steam, as is the White House pushback against it. And just days after President Trump announced U.S. troops would vacate a key part of Syria and leave U.S. allied Kurdish forces behind, Turkey's president announced the launch of a military operation into Kurdish-dominated northern Syria. We'll dig into those stories and more in our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions and thoughts do you have about how Congress is dealing with the impeachment inquiry in the House, reactions in the U.S. Senate as well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. By the way, she's a graduate of Marquette University. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, since we heard this surprising announcement from the president that he'd move U.S. troops out of this part of Syria, a number of senior Republicans, normally supportive of the president, have criticized his decision, not all of them. What are some of the key things we've been hearing from Republican senators?
Republicans are very concerned, and like you said, these are Trump's traditional allies in Congress, but they're very concerned about the Kurds in Syria, and they argue that the Trump administration with this decision is abandoning a key ally in a really important region. The United States isn't living up to the promise that we've made to defend the Kurds, they say. And Lindsey Graham, who has been one of Trump's closest friends on Capitol Hill, says that he wants to introduce a Senate resolution urging Trump to reconsider the decision, as well as impose sanctions on Turkey for stepping into Syria. So yet to be seen if that's going to move forward. But if it does, it's fair to assume that the vast majority of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, would support that. It wouldn't have policy implications, but could be an embarrassment to the president. There were several other Republicans speaking out today, urging the president to make a last-minute decision, change of course. Clearly, that has not happened.
Yeah, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, among Republican senators reacting to the president. Republican members of Congress have not generally been willing to speak out too openly against the president on issues. Why is this particular story, do you think, something where they're willing to be very public with their disagreement here?
Well, you know, Republicans are very concerned about foreign policy. They're concerned about the potential rise of ISIS. They argue that doing this will allow ISIS to regain strength. Also, they feel like the Kurds need the defense of the United States in an area where they have no other allies. And finally, there's a somewhat of a religious argument to be made here that this is a persecuted people and the United States should stand for defending those who need defending. And so there's a lot of reasons that Republicans have spoken out. Obviously, Democrats don't support this decision either, but their opposition to the president's decision is a little less surprising.
And the president tweeted, I think this was yesterday, at quoting, "As I have stated strongly before, and just to reiterate, if Turkey does anything that I, in my great and unmatched wisdom, consider to be off limits, I will totally destroy and obliterate the economy of Turkey. I've done before." He went on, "They must, with Europe and others, watch over the captured ISIS fighters and families." So the president, after this initial move, warning Turkey against anything that he considers off limits, has that been fleshed out at all?
No, not much. That tweet came out right after Republicans really started to speak out against the president's decision. So I interpreted that tweet as a walking back his prior comments a little bit. And in fact, several Republicans speculated that the president may be reconsidering his decision. Of course, things are moving very quickly over there, so it does not appear that there even is time for the president to reconsider his decision. But President Trump has said, or at least has indicated, that this was a campaign promise. And one of his few allies on this decision, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, said that this is really the fulfillment of a campaign promise to get the United States out of foreign wars. And clearly the president feels like this is something he has to do for that reason.
And beyond what we've heard out loud from members of both chambers of commerce, what's the mood like on Capitol Hill on this particular Syria issue?
Well, lawmakers are out of session, so they're back in their districts. But I'd have to say this kind of outrage from Republicans is relatively rare, particularly from Republicans in the House who are among Trump's strongest allies right now. I mean, Senate Republicans have been willing to speak out against the administration on a handful of issues, but this is one in which, you know, you're hearing it from just about every part of the Republican conference right now, even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who chooses his words extremely carefully and seldom says something an exact opposite of what the president's doing. But he too, put out a statement warning that this is a bad idea and is going to have horrible implications.
Talking to Jennifer Habercorn. She covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She's with us for our weekly look at some of the latest news in national politics. Jen, let's move over to the impeachment inquiry now. Yesterday, we were expecting to see a deposition in Congress by the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. That ended up not going forward. What happened?
So he got a notice from his bosses at the State Department just a few hours before the deposition was supposed to take place, saying that he should not participate. And, you know, this deposition was pretty high stakes, in part because this was the first person who works currently in the administration who would be deposed by Congress and had agreed to without a subpoena. And the State Department stepped in, said you're not allowed to participate. And as an employee of the State Department, he said that he, through his lawyer, he said that he wanted to participate but had to listen to his bosses. And this sent the first clear signal that the administration was not going to even put up auspices of participating in the House's impeachment investigation. Of course, there's little reason to think that the administration would want to participate in an impeachment inquiry, but this sent the signal that no, they are not going to do so at all. Just a couple hours later, the White House put out a rather blistering letter to Congress saying that they are not going to, this impeachment inquiry is invalid. They don't agree with it. They think it's a witch hunt, and they're not going to turn over any documents or allow any of their officials to be deposed by congressional investigators. So this really sets the stage for what's, you know, a major constitutional clash between the legislative branch, which feels like its authority is to oversee the executive and investigate where they think is warranted, and the executive branch, which says that it does not need to be party to any of that. And, you know, where this goes in the next couple weeks is going to be fraught with, you know, we already have a lot of folks citing founding fathers and the Constitution, and it's really significant stakes.
Now, Gordon Sondland, Ambassador Sondland's testimony, people were really interested in it in part because of Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson telling the Wall Street Journal that Ambassador Sondland had suggested to him that there was a quid pro quo, this for that deal where military aid might be held up with the Ukraine in exchange for Ukraine agreeing to investigate a couple points of interest for President Trump. That's mm-hmm. That captured a lot of attention, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. And investigators want to know everything about that conversation at this point. They want to know what specifically was at stake, who directed, who within the administration directed some of these key decisions. I assume if he had shown up, he would have been in there for hours answering loads of questions for both Republicans and Democrats.
We're on a caller on the impeachment inquiry at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my question regarding the impeachment inquiry is that shouldn't the Democrats have a vote to authorize the impeachment inquiry so that at least it appears fair? I mean, currently, the other side is not given the chance to subpoena witnesses, to look at the evidence, and a lot of the due process things that went on with Clinton and Nixon's impeachment are not being employed. Shouldn't we be doing those things so that at least appears that this isn't a witch hunt and we can actually get to the bottom of things?
Charlie, thanks for the call. And that's been an argument within Congress and from the White House as well, John.
That's right. It's really become one of the key points of contention in this debate. You'll remember Speaker Pelosi just, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, announced that the House would be in an inquiry and move forward in potentially impeach the president. But they did not hold a vote in the House. This really just Pelosi decided we're doing this, and that was that. And at the time, Democrats told me that they didn't need to do an inquiry vote because one of the key differences between now and the last time the House tried to impeach a president, of course, President Clinton, the House chairman didn't have the power to subpoena. Since then, rules have changed, Congress has changed, and now chairmen do have that power. But the caller is right. Right now, Republicans, because they're in the minority, they don't have the power to subpoena. And presumably, if the House were to vote to officially open up an inquiry, they would have that power. And of course, Republicans have plenty of people they would want to subpoena. You can imagine former Vice President Joe Biden or his son Hunter Biden would be key folks that they would want to bring in for questioning. So far, Speaker Pelosi is saying, no, we're not going to do a vote. We don't need to do it. Republicans are going to keep up the push for one. And that was one of the key points the White House raised in the letter that I mentioned. They think a vote needs to happen. As of right now, I don't think that's going to change, but it's something that I'm going to be looking out for when Congress returns next week, whether Pelosi feels like she needs to do this vote to just merely get the procedural argument off the table.
We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn, Los Angeles Times congressional reporter. We're talking with her about Syria, impeachment, and other top stories in national politics this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump? What do you want to see happen in the House, ultimately in the Senate? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Jennifer Habercorn. She reports on Congress for the Los Angeles Times. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Jen, one concern for Democrats is, okay, is there going to be a backlash against anybody who supports this impeachment inquiry or supports further moves toward impeachment? You went to some congressional town halls. What kind of things did you see?
That's right. I went to three town halls in districts in which voters elected President Trump in 2016, and then in 2018 they flipped and supported a Democrat for their representative in Congress. And so these are some of the districts that are going to be most important because they're swing districts, much like Wisconsin will be in the 2020 election. And what I found is that people are really cemented in their camps. Folks who voted for the president in 2016 are committed to him, don't think the inquiry is a good idea. Some are very adamant that it's a horrible idea. Others say, you know, we knew this was going to happen. He's not going to be removed from office. This is just more of the same Washington politics. And Democrats who oppose the president love that the impeachment inquiry is moving forward. Some are a bit skeptical that it's a good idea, exactly for the reasons you cited, that it could be bad politics. But there's very few people in the middle. You know, President Trump is such a figure who draws such strong reactions that there's very few people who are kind of in between. But what's going to be interesting is if the House does move forward with a vote on articles for impeachment, which at this point I do expect that's going to happen, does that change at all? So far we've seen the polls are open to the idea that the president should face an inquiry, or at least that questions should be raised about his conversations with the Ukrainian president. But actually holding a vote whether to impeach the president is an entirely different thing. And Democrats are hoping that their investigations, you know, really lay out for the public exactly what happened. They had some text messages came out last week that showed some of his administration officials, including Sondland, discussing the idea of a quid pro quo, but you know they're hoping to get to tell the story more thoroughly for the public. So you know at these town halls, what I found was that people are cemented in their position, and as this moves forward in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be interested to see how this vote on the articles plays out.
Now, for whatever side people were on, did you see a lot of people coming up to the mic or however they laid it out at these town halls and talking about impeachment in particular, or are they focused on other issues too?
It was very much other issues. Impeachment did come up, of course, but it was not the dominant conversation. And that was really interesting to me. I expected it to come up quite a bit more, but people were talking about the Green New Deal, which is the Democrats' climate change initiative. They were talking about healthcare policy. They were talking about transportation policy. It was a big variety of issues. And, you know, the lawmakers in these districts went to great lengths to explain and defend their position, but that was kind of it. There wasn't a ton of excitement. So, you know, it's early in what could be a lengthy impeachment process, but it's not dominating voters' thoughts right now, which suggests to me that voters might come to the polls in 2020 focused on other issues.
Talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the Los Angeles Times, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. This impeachment issue is coming into the presidential race as well. Former Vice President Joe Biden, Democratic candidate for president, for the first time publicly called for Donald Trump's impeachment. This was today, I think, Biden speaking at a campaign event in New Hampshire.
With his words and his actions, President Trump has indicted himself by obstructing justice, refusing to comply with the congressional inquiry. He's already convicted himself in full view of the world and the American people. Donald Trump has violated his oath of office, betrayed this nation, and committed impeachable acts.
Joe Biden has been a key target for Donald Trump through this process here. What do you make of Biden personally calling for impeachment for the first time today?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like a lot of Democrats feel like there's very little to lose by supporting impeachment. There are very few Democrats who are opposed to the inquiry at this point, or at least haven't come out to support it, one of them being Ron Kind in Wisconsin. He has a very moderate district. Trump won that district by a hair. But there's very few Democrats in that position. And so Biden is merely joining the vast majority of his party, which supports this impeachment inquiry right now. And so it wasn't a terrible surprise. If anything, he would have been even more of an outlier for the rest of the 2020 field, which came out for an inquiry many months ago.
Let's bring on another caller. John is with us in Appleton. John, hi.
Hi. The question I had was earlier you were discussing the requirement of a vote before the impeachment could go ahead. And I thought I had heard that a change that was made by the Republicans during the Clinton impeachment meant that that particular vote that the president is pushing for is not required. Does your reporter know anything about that?
John, thanks for the call. Jen, do you know?
Yeah, so since Clinton's impeachment, the rules in the House have changed, and chairmen don't need the approval by the full House to issue a subpoena, which, of course, they need in this situation. But Democrats argue that they don't need to hold a vote to actually start an inquiry. Of course, Republicans argue that you do need a vote just to start an inquiry. This really comes down to politics more than procedure. Republicans want to hold that vote because they want to force Democrats in some of these tough districts to get on the record. But of course, Republicans would have to get on the record too. And there's a possibility that a couple Republicans would join the inquiry. So this is not about procedure. This is pretty much about politics right now.
And as I understand it, the Constitution leaves things a little loosey-goosey on impeachment. There's not a really very clear, specified path of how this works within the House itself.
Exactly. The Constitution does not lay out any of these rules, so it's up to Congress itself to determine how it actually has to move forward. And there's no technical reason to do the inquiry vote, at least right now.
Let's bring on one more caller. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hello.
Hi. Yeah, at this point, the Democrats have got everything to gain and nothing to lose. The Republicans haven't had a 30-year smear campaign on any of the Democratic candidates. So, and furthermore, at this point, 3 years of chaos, anybody who thinks logically can clearly see where the corruption lies.
Eric, thanks for the call. And that's an argument we're hearing from some Democrats. Really not much to lose here.
Exactly. Particularly progressive Democrats. I mean, some of them have been calling for the president's impeachment for, basically since he was elected. And there's a real concern that if Democrats don't respond to their base, they could, face repercussions in the 2020 election. House Democrats argue that they were elected, one, to protect consumers' health care, and two, to hold the president accountable. And for some Democrats, that means investigating whether impeachment is warranted and, in fact, holding an impeachment vote. So that's very much a concern. And I think the caller speaks to some of the concern that a lot of progressive Democrats in Congress are making.
Thanks for that call. Jen, in our last minutes, as Congress comes back into session, is there a non-impeachment issue you're really watching out for?
I wish there were. Impeachment is definitely taking up all the oxygen here in Washington. But I'm also looking at the USMCA, the trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, which is known as the second version of NAFTA, the New Mexico Free Trade Agreement, as well as prescription drugs, whether that has any prospects. There's an argument to be made that both Republicans and Democrats want to send the message to voters that they are not just talking about impeachment, that there's other issues going on. And so remains to be seen whether they can actually come together on one of these legislative proposals while impeachment hangs in the air.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was great to talk with you.
That's Jennifer Habercorn. She covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. We talked with her about the White House pushing back against the impeachment inquiry in the U.S. House and other top news this week out of Washington. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts on the impeachment inquiry and where you want to see it go. Or not go, for that matter. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. As always, you can tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Do you want to see the U.S. House have a vote on proceeding with the impeachment inquiry? Do you want to see Democrats move quickly to an actual vote on impeachment? And if so, what do you hope comes out of all of this in the U.S. Senate, assuming the U.S. House sends it to the other chamber of Congress? Tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Riddle: what's black and white and not red all over? Answer: a cow that's been painted with zebra stripes. What's that? No, it's not a children's joke written by an artificial intelligence program. It's a finding in a new research study that aims to protect cows from insect bites. As published in the journal PLOS-1 and reported on the CNN website, researchers in Japan took a team of six cows. They broke them into groups of two. Two cows were painted with black and white stripes, like a zebra. Two cows were painted with just black stripes, like a half zebra. Two cows were not painted at all, like a cow. Then they let them all hang out for about half an hour. Then they counted the horsefly bites each cow received. The unpainted cows and the black stripe-only cows got more than 110 bites in that half hour. But the zebra stripe cows got fewer than 60 bites in the same stretch of time. Apparently, this might be why zebras have stripes in the first place. Researchers say the stripes mess with a fly's ability to see and makes it harder to land on the zebra, or in this case, the cow that's painted like a zebra. Biting flies are blamed for billions of dollars of losses in productivity in the global dairy industry, so this is a big deal. This catches on. It could be a growth job here in Wisconsin, cow painter. And could this work for people and mosquitoes? I say we need some research here in the state. It's fall. We got to get this in quick. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.